Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
On the last episode of Guilt.
They were different to other people that you're dealing with. And they were hard cookies to crack. They didn't say anything. Almost all interviews were no comment. And it was just, you tried, but you often felt like you weren't winning.
But I just had this terrible feeling when she said she's meeting up with people that there's something not, I'm not real.
Yes.
Bad gut feeling, bad gut feeling.
The family of a Melton teenager who died 6 years ago are for the first time appealing for further information about the girl's death before the release of a coroner's finding later this month.
But she was just so happy, so bubbly, smiling all the time. Like, she was just so much fun to be around. She was just beautiful.
If I could go back now knowing what I know now, they'd be dead. Yeah, I'd be in jail.
And she got stolen away from me. And those culprits who did it, I want to catch them. I want to get them. And they know who they are. And I won't ever give up.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe. And this is Guilt.
Where that girl was X-ray is, and whether it is X, Y, or I don't think you've established that. So you haven't sort of done, and you've said to me there's many theories, and I don't think there's many theories. There's the Malcolm Barney theory, there's what's the Caramac theory, the worst part, the stabbing incident, and obviously there's pedophile. But you haven't really tried to put these things at me, and not my family, after 6 years, and I think it's the statements. The timeline of statements taken and things like that probably prove that it's been pretty slapdash sort of my investigation. And I'm pretty as my family is and I am.
The voice that you cannot so clearly hear in that audio is that of Alana's father, Peter Cecil. I apologise for the sound quality, but this was recorded on tape at the mention hearing during the inquest into the death of Alana Cecil 22 years ago, on August 12, 2002. After 6 long years of adjournments and delays, Peter was finally given the opportunity to make a submission regarding the investigation into Alana's death. And he didn't hold back. Over 2 hours, he put questions to Senior Detective Hythorn on the stand in the coroner's court, arguing that the investigation into Alana's case had been, in his opinion, lacking. At the time of this hearing in 2002, the DNA profiles of the two men whose semen was present on Alana had not yet been matched. In 2008, this would change. But for now, let's jump back to that courtroom and listen to the final words of Coroner Byrne.
Mr. Hythorn, Mr. Cecil just referred to a number of theories.
Yes.
There are probably, 4 principal theories? Correct me if I'm wrong. Potential theories.
Yes.
I stress theories at this point in time. whether they're four or whether they're five,
yeah.
Have you been able to locate any compellable evidence to support any one of the theories?
No.
Do you believe that if at some stage you get a positive DNA identification, that will then give you an opportunity to pursue perhaps one or other or more of the theories?
Yes.
Perhaps.
Perhaps.
Yeah. I just give you the opportunity to respond, because what Mr. Cecil has done has basically made a fairly damning condemnation of your investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fairness, yeah. I'm required to give you an opportunity to respond. If you want to, you don't have to. It's up to you.
No, I've made all the inquiries I could make at the time, given obviously the time frame involved, and the persons involved, their nature, their... see, from the outset, it appeared that she died of a heroin overdose with the asthma, and that there was nothing really criminally involved in the matter.
And had you conceded that amongst these various statements there are glaring inconsistencies?
Yeah, I had that discussion with Mr. Cecil a number of times in the past.
You believe, are they inconsistencies at this point in time that you can't resolve?
That's right.
You believe it's due to the nature of the individual's concern primarily.
Yes. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Eithorne. You may resume your seat. With no other matters you wish to raise, were there, Ms. Fitzgerald? If there were, I'll...
No, Senior. Your Worship, I think you've covered all the questions for examination.
Mr. Cecil, I think basically you made your submission a moment ago, but if there's anything you want to add... now's the opportunity.
No, I just whether rearrange, I think there's a lot to be learned from this, and like most people,
there are lots of unanswered questions.
There's a lot of unanswered questions, but I do think it's I make DNA evidence as a new way. There might be a lot of as was pointed out by. It's a really difficult area at the moment, so you...
The prospects are, bearing in mind the sorts of individuals we're talking about, that sooner or later there will be a match. Now, how far that's going to take it remains to be seen. Depends who the match is, depends if they're interviewed, what their position is. You understand, I take it, that an individual is not required to make a statement to police. They're not required to provide DNA unless they fit within that statutory category that they're then required, and if necessary, forcibly required to provide a sample. And I agree, there are lots of unanswered questions. And in a moment, I'll tell you what I propose and then give you an opportunity to respond. Is there anything else you wish to say at this point in time?
I just also... I'd like to say that I take it into account the DNA evidence, but I don't believe that I think today's, as far as I'm concerned, that there are gross inconsistencies in statements, and I take your point, that doesn't relate to the culture.
The cost, did you say?
No, I'm saying that I'm...
Culture.
I thought you said the cost, because the cost is of no significance to me.
Related to some of those statements, it considers that they're fairly blatant, and I assume that normal police investigating work, the hard yards, will never be put in, and not to have your hat sitting on the DNA hat that run, and hopefully that will solve it for you, given the circumstances that it's still open in it, and the court, or no, the Drift Lifeline hasn't proved to me, one way or the other, that it wasn't a homicide, nor whether it was an accidental death. Until those unanswered questions, through a proper and thorough investigation, which entails, getting to the meat,
What makes you think that some of the further inquiries that you've mentioned today are going to establish whether this was a homicide or an accidental death? I must say, with respect, I think you've been a little mystic.
Well, I think I pointed out that there's crucial people that have not basically on the loose end of which theory that haven't been caught up with. And,
I hear what you say, but what makes you think that interviewing extra people rather than just speaking with them and some of them haven't been spoken with is going to provide any definitive answer? I think you'll probably find, I'd be willing to suggest, that's probably just more complications, more inconsistency, perhaps supporting one or other of the theories. But I can't make findings on speculation. That's basically the bottom line. The nature of this inquiry is such, and the nature of the people involved and what they've said, I think is going to leave me in a position where I'm not going to be satisfactorily persuaded as to one version or the other. And I'm prepared to indicate now that if I were to make a finding on the material I have at the moment, it would, for all intents and purposes, be an open finding. I would not discount foul play. I would say it is possible that she didn't self-inject, but was injected. It's possible that the intercourse was non-consensual. On the other hand, I don't believe that the material or any potential material I'm going to get now, unless DNA turns up something in the future, is going to give me material which will be of sufficient evidentiary weight to make a positive finding. It seems to me that the best one can do at this point in time and in the foreseeable future is to make, in effect, an open finding. Do you take my point? Do you understand what I'm saying? If you don't, I'll try to shorten it somewhat.
I do take your point.
Okay. And there's another point I want to make, and that is, I think the thing just can't go on indefinitely. When I first got this file, it was my first impression. There has to be a point at some stage where you say, this matter has to be concluded. Well, whether it's concluded forever remains to be seen. But some, either temporary or permanent conclusion. And, as I say, it'd be in the form of, if I were to proceed on the material I have at this stage, in effect an open finding. The only thing one can be sure of is that Alana died of the heroin overdose in combination with the asthma. As I said, accidental homicide. The point I meant to make, but I lost track of myself there for a second, was an inquest, once opened and a finding made, is always subject to reopening on the basis of any new material becoming available. And it may be that if the matter were to proceed to a tentative conclusion shortly, it's going to be reopened if any further material comes to light, particularly in light of the technology surrounding DNA. But I just don't see that you're going to benefit, your family are going to benefit, that anything significant is going to be achieved by a further delay. The people you've said should be interviewed, there are some bases for interviewing them, but there are others that aren't. And I'm just not sure how far it's going to advance the matter. I'm almost positive it's not going to advance the matter. And I suspect certainly that it's not going to advance the matter to a stage where I can make a positive finding of foul play, if that were the case.
I'll be, just one more, but I'd be absolutely delighted down the track someone makes an application to reopen this and there's additional material, because I also feel, and it's one of the real difficulties with this jurisdiction, I also feel uncomfortable doing that. But in lots of matters, it's the only finding you can ultimately make. It's virtually a non-finding, isn't it? It's saying, look, material available just isn't sufficient, but I don't see that there's going to be much that we gain by pursuing the matter further at this point in time. A couple of other matters. If I hold a full-blown inquest and speed up these people, I can guarantee that the great percentage will say, I do not wish to be heard on the basis of a may accommodate myself. It's one of the real frustrations of this jurisdiction, but it's a fundamental tenet of our judicial system from top to bottom. I think some people think that this is the forum where you could bring them down and get stuck right into it. All they got to do is say, try to plot to answer on the basis of my incriminate yourself. And the law, not my idea, the law provides that I have to say a true privilege. It's a shield. Now, whether our justice system is just is another issue. Whether you should, but there are some who say you should have the power to force people to answer. But the authorities, the higher priests, consistently said that's not the case. In which the last month they reiterated that position. But if you want a few moments to think about it, have a chat with family members and other people here supporting you, there just seems to me time might be coming to there's something else comes to light.
On October 17th, 2002, another brief hearing effectively concluded the police investigation into the death of Alana Cecil. In his summing up, Coroner Byrne effectively made an open finding and stated in part, "I am able to say that when found, her clothing was in disarray. Her panties were back to front, inside out, and the bottom two of four fly buttons were not done up. Like several aspects of this case, that is open to various interpretations. It is entirely possible she was hurriedly dressed by others after collapsing. The circumstances surrounding the death of Miss Cecil leave me with a number of unanswered or inadequately answered questions. Number one, forensic evidence establishes that shortly prior to her death, Miss Cecil had sexual relations with two men. The issue arises whether that sexual activity was consensual or non-consensual. Two, toxicology analysis of post-mortem specimens established death was due to heroin toxicity. The question is, did she self-inject or was she injected by another? And if she was injected by another, was that at her request or against her wishes? Three, another question is, did she die at the location where the body was found or was her body relocated from elsewhere after her collapse, even death? 4. Was she the victim of foul play? Or does her death merely represent another tragic but non-suspicious drug overdose? I propose findings in relation to these issues. On the evidence available, I cannot exclude the prospect that sexual relations between the two unidentified men was not consensual. The evidence establishes that Alana did not like self-injecting heroin and usually asked a friend to actually intravenously inject her. It is entirely possible that someone unidentified injected the heroin that resulted in Alana's death. If that was the case, whether such injection was requested, I am unable to say. It is likely a reduced tolerance to heroin, given she had apparently been clean for 3 months, may have contributed to this overdose and death. I think it unlikely Alana actually died at the location where her body was located. I consider it more likely her body was relocated from an unknown location after she collapsed or died. Whilst Alana Cecil's death may represent yet another, albeit tragic, heroin overdose, the known circumstances surrounding her death do not enable me to comfortably exclude the prospect she was the victim of foul play. And with this open finding, Alana's case effectively became dormant. The investigation no longer active, but waiting for that new piece of evidence to spark the case back into life. And 6 years later, in 2008, that spark came. But instead of hearing what happened from me, I gave Peter a call and asked him to take me through the emotional roller coaster that has been Alana's case and that discovery in 2008.
Leading up, when it was established that Alana died at the scene, there was an allocation of to an investigative officer in the name of Jeff Hythorn, and then I was informed by Jeff Hythorn that this was going to be a bit of a challenge for him because he'd been allocated the job without any experience with a coroner's court, which I found a little bit daunting, but because I was still grieving and I wanted to make sure that everything was above board in terms of the investigation being pretty thorough, even though it was a post-mortem investigation, and knowing what happened to Alana. So with that, it was a pretty much a journey of a journey of 6 years of a horror story in terms of the investigation. And there was a lot of things that happened during that investigation, which I'm not going to touch on right now, but leading up to trying to get it to inquest. Now, Jeff Hythorn had told me that it would be off his table in 11 months, and that, basically because he straight away assumed that it was just a drug overdose, and that's the way he treated it. And it wasn't, as we all know, as it was until I examined the autopsy report, toxicology report, and knew what Alana was like at the time, that I questioned, I had other old things, and certainly when the other evidence turned up, was established with the scene, etc., and she'd been relocated there by from another place, and obviously no witnesses had come forward. Yeah, Jeff Hythorn himself said it was a strange case, and he was a bit of a nonplussed for witnesses not coming forward at the time.
Peter's going to take us through this, but before we continue, let's just quickly cover the timeline of Alana's case through the coronial investigation. On the 3rd of October 1997, 11 months after Alana's death, an inquest was planned and then adjourned due to a lack of investigation. In January of 1998, at Alana's family's insistence, swabs taken from Alana's body were finally analysed and showed the presence of not one, but two unidentified male semen profiles. On the 2nd of November 1998, a second inquest was planned and then adjourned due to a lack of investigation. On the 13th of March 2001, a third inquest was planned and then adjourned due to a lack of investigation. Finally, 6 years after Alana's death, the mention hearing that you heard earlier in this episode was held at the coroner's court, and Coroner Byrne made his open finding.
This is the way it was being treated right through. This one I had to, right, I had okay. No, I was carrying a lot of things in this, as you're aware of. I tried to get it over to the homicide squad, and I was told that he hadn't, the investigative officer hadn't done enough investigation work on it, and he wasn't prepared to put it over, give it to him, based on, what I'd put to them, which has come out now. What happened was obviously the 11 months was a ridiculous time to get the investigation underway, and there was a lot of things not completed to have any inquest completed either. So we basically got to a stage in 1997.
Yeah,
on the 3rd of and as requested by the Office of the State Coroner, Hythorn was completed a brief of evidence and submitted to the coroner within a month and a half of the death of Alana, which he obviously couldn't do. But then it was a date was set on the 2nd of October 1997, where there was an inquest scheduled. But unfortunately, again, Jeff Hythorn hadn't completed enough investigation, according to the coroner's assistant and the coroner. And also there was witnesses had come forward who had seen Alana at the Dirrawarra Festival, and they hadn't yet been interviewed by Hawthorne. So there's no way known that that was going to take place, and it was adjourned due to the lack of investigation. Also, at that particular time, the swabs weren't analysed, which were pretty important to the case. And Jeff Hawthorne, through his lack of experience, I guess, had to be prompted to do them. And they weren't done until January of 2008. So it's 2 years later.
'98.
So these swabs weren't, at that particular time, weren't completed. So these, the swabs were analysed, and it was two, again, the investigative officer had to be asked whether the ones were analysed and that the sex that had taken place on Alana, that he was had to be prompted again by my partner Christine as to, you know, he identified that it was sperm and the sex had taken place, but he didn't find out whether it was how many males or were involved in it. So he had to go back. He basically said he didn't think about it. So he had to go back and do that. And then he came back, and then it was divulged that there was two males involved in the sex on Alana.
Yeah. And that, so in terms of when you get through, so after that first inquest, were you thinking at that point, okay, right, they're going to go away now, they're actually going to do some work and something might happen here? You know, they test the swabs, and then so now you come forward to the 2nd of November 1998, and there's the second inquest. And at this point, did you feel like, okay, something's going to happen now, or were you still thinking they've not done enough work here?
Well, it's pretty simple. The coroner's assistant, Wayne Coleman, came up to me and said, "Has Detective Hawthorne taken your statement?" I said, "No, he hadn't." And he said, "And he made him do it there at the coroner's court in 98. And it was adjourned again.
Wow. So you showed up at the court expecting an inquest, and then it ends up.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That must have been difficult to deal with.
I was, as I said to you, I dealt with a lot up to that point, and it couldn't have been any worse, to tell you the truth. It was just, it was frustrating, but I still supported Hawthorne because he was my best vehicle to get to where I needed to be, or find out what happened to Alana. So I still supported Hawthorne a lot, irrespective, even though I had my reservations on his ability to do it, complete it, especially after two adjournments like that. And but I, like I said, I stuck with him in the hope that he'd get things done. But unfortunately, there was another one scheduled for the 13th of March 2001. I was only informed, basically, or the family was only informed about on a weekend before the Tuesday that it was called. I didn't even know about it, so there was no we weren't even told really that it was going to be on. Anyhow, what I did, I actually alerted the family that it was going to be on, and I, my parents were living in Queensland at the time, and they flew down for it to attend the inquest on the expected day. And then Jeff Hawthorne came up to me about 20 minutes prior to the scheduled commencement, at about probably 9:40 or something around that, and that the hearing would not be held to the fact that the subpoenas hadn't been served to expected witnesses. And I was pretty angry at this time. I was definitely angry. And because I believe that this information was normally passed on to the investigative officer in advance of the hearing date, and we all turned up to the court.
Yeah. Did you make it known to him that day? Did you give him a piece of your mind?
No, I didn't. No, I'm not like that. I'm not that sort of person. But I was angry underneath, obviously. And obviously the family were pretty upset about it. And certainly my parents, who'd flown down from Queensland, and my father being an ex-policeman as well, he wasn't impressed at all by the whole thing, process. But that was a bad day for me as well, because the coroner's assistant, Jane Welsh, had came up and she actually asked Jeff Hythorn when he expected to complete the investigation, but he wasn't unable to give an answer to the coroner's assistant. And she suggested, how about March or July, which was agreed to by him. That was back in 98. But again, nothing. The coroner's assistant, Jane Wells, said that she'd help review the case with Hythorn and have him complete his investigations. But I didn't hear from him, and there was not on the progress of the case. And I was actually sitting in a chair in the thing after this meeting took place with Jane Welsh, and she came up to me and tapped me on the shoulder, and she asked me to go easy on him. And this is fact. And she said that she basically went on the theme that she felt that Detective Hythorn's workload and the cost to the system in obtaining the DNA evidence that was asking too much of him at the time in terms of his workload. Jeff Hythorn, once the DNA was available, Jeff Hythorn thought that this was the only way that he was going to find out what happened to Alana. And he basically stipulated that to me straight away. And that's the approach he took. There was no really investigative work as such, because there was no cross-checking of statements, discrepancies. It was pretty much a straightforward DNA process investigation.
What Peter is saying here is, once there were two unidentified DNA profiles available to police, it's his opinion that they then sat on these in the hope that a match would simply fall into their lap and solve the case, instead of chasing what Peter believed at the time were genuine leads.
He was just playing the DNA lottery.
That was the
DNA lottery.
He was DNAing. It was a DNA lottery, exactly. And that's why it was so poorly done at the start. And obviously Jane Welsh felt that it was a cost to the system.
What do you say?
He couldn't keep. I was upset from the fact that it lacked support. The lack of support. It said to me that enough's enough. And I thought that it also said to me that they couldn't get it to inquest, and because he hadn't been able to achieve the aim of solving the case or finding out what happened to Alana, because he was at a quandary. He didn't know. He was at loss with the case, to tell the truth.
So it was a
ship sailing with no rudder.
You're expecting from Hythorn not the world. You know, what was it you were expecting from him at that time in terms of the case?
Well, I was expecting him to do his job.
Yeah.
Well, I was expecting him to do his job. I was a grieving parent, and I expected him to be able to go around and do his work and investigate the case and go and talk to people and obviously obtain their statements and you know who were relevant, especially in terms of the timeline of Alana on the day, and also you know basically. Yeah, the people who were involved, and because he treated it as a case with no just a standard overdose with no suspicion, and he felt that there was just a party in Melton and. That overdose took place, and they put Alana there, probably too frightened, probably, you know, being friends and stuff. It was basically the approach he took, and so it didn't meet my ends because I found that he was relaxed in his approach, and he wasn't going to talk to people like I was looking for him to. To get back to me and say, look, I've talked to this person, that person, but he didn't do it. He just took his time, just dragged it out, which was, and I found it very frustrating to tell the truth. It was a horror story. I'd ring up and he was non-contactable. He'd be on leave. I'd pick up information. I wanted to pass on to him, but I was told that he was the only one that could handle it. And no one else could with the information, so I had to hold on to it. Nothing was being done in terms of a thing. I actually had to prompt him too often to get things done. In the end, he admitted to me that I probably did more in the investigation than him at the time, which was a pretty big thing, but actually going to find witnesses for him. And I shouldn't have had to because my family were you know worried that I was going to territory where you know my safety was at risk. It shouldn't have happened, but I was able to go. I was able to find him when he couldn't find them, and he made out he couldn't find him. And I was really just disappointed. That's where it went.
Did you feel at that point basically you felt like if I don't go out and look for these people, it's just not going to happen?
That's correct. And I that's what I did. And I didn't want to go, but I had no option because I just basically talked to the people that he should have been speaking to find these people. And I found them. Yeah, and I just – he didn't really – I can't say much about this, but on this, but, yeah, because – Yeah, I can say a lot of things, and I don't want to say anything at all.
That's fine.
Jeff Hythorn.
Yeah. The next thing, so we go through that, and at this
point... Can I just make one more point on that, yep. too? I think it's very important that people understand about this investigation itself, because I don't want other people to go through it as well, but I'm pretty disappointed. Like, the police let me down in general, in the whole thing. And I'm saying this now because the investigation, I should never have got to this point now because if things had been done properly in the first place, it would have probably been solved. I've got to admit, I haven't got any respect. I was brought up by a policeman. And I had a respect for the police, but I actually lost it when in this particular, you know, with Alana's case and the way I was being treated by them and the way it was being conducted by the fact that he was resolved, you know, I did try to get Jeff Hythorn moving a lot of time, you know, a number of times, and I was just basically rebuked by... people have got to remember too that during this time of investigation, you know, Detective Hythorn lost his police license for 12 months, and also And he wasn't. He had to rely on other police to get and to get a vehicle available to do to interview. And this is something else I had to put up with. And he failed to get, you know, basically see a couple of witnesses, which frustrated me to the hilt because one was very important and wasn't interviewed till the second investigation took place in 2008. So I, this is the police exonerated him. Two SD inquiries took place under Inspector Cordy and Glenane, Detective Sergeant Glenane. They both exonerated him and said that he was doing a good job. The police ombudsman, who I wrote to because I was forced to in response, which was David Hicks, the police ombudsman of Victoria, he wasn't that impressed because during that time, which I haven't mentioned either, is that Detective Hythorn missed vital evidence, which he should have got obtained. And the ombudsman, Hicks, stated that there was a bad mistake on his part for missing the vital evidence. He also wasn't impressed with the tardiness of him taking his statements, and nor was he impressed with the length of time of the investigation, and stated in the report that it was an indictment on the Victoria Police.
There's no doubt that Peter carries a great deal of built-up resentment over how he believes Jeff Hythorn handled Alana's case. Part of this is natural. In my experience, every family I've ever spoken to and every case I've worked on has always believed the police didn't do an adequate job. But I've been through and reviewed this case, and I can see why Peter feels the way he does. Some key witnesses weren't interviewed until years after Alana's death. Key CCTV video wasn't obtained and is now lost. It goes on and on. But I can confirm that many witnesses were spoken to and had statements taken, some on multiple occasions. Also, it shouldn't be considered an excuse, but most of the individuals involved in this case did come from difficult backgrounds, which featured drug use, and their lifestyles, according to Hythorn, made it difficult to track people down. Although, on most occasions, Peter himself was able to find these people with relative ease. With all that in mind, we need to consider that this is Peter's view of how the investigation unfolded. But I want you to understand the emotional struggle he was going through. On one hand, grieving the death of his only daughter, and on the other, his belief that if he didn't investigate this case himself, pursue justice for Alana, then no one would.
You know, okay, so you get through, so then eventually we get to the mention hearing, which is in 2002. And, you know, and that's very interesting. And it's the first time it's heard in court, the facts of the case, and you get a chance to basically cross-examine Hythorn.
That's correct.
Yeah. Tell me about, you know, just briefly about that process and going through that in 2002.
Well, it was another frustrating day, another time. It started off in bad fashion because Jeff Hythorn again came up to me not long before the start of it and stated that a crucial witness wouldn't be available because he was ill fit to can't attend. But I was pretty disappointed in that because this particular witness was a witness that had seen Alana at the Jarrah Festival, claimed to, and identified a number of people that she was surrounding her at the time. And there was another witness who was with that particular person. And the Jeff Hythorn, in his failed to obtain a statement and even interview this particular witness. at the time, and he wasn't available to fill in, obviously. So that was totally frustrating because it was fairly important, because our coroner Byrne didn't get to hear any of that evidence. The other part was that Jeff Hythorn had failed to, well, I couldn't work it out, but there's a number of key alibi witnesses that weren't subpoenaed to the hearing. They just didn't turn up. Now, to this day, I can tell you, I wouldn't even have a clue whether they were subpoenaed or not. And I couldn't work out why they weren't followed up by the coroner's court anyway, because if you're subpoenaed, you basically have to be there. And you've got to give a pretty good reason why you're not. And there's probably about, there's at least four of them not there. And they were key alibi witnesses to the day that Alana...
After the mention hearing, there's another hearing on the 15th of October, and there's not much more comes from that, I understand.
That's correct.
And so then after that one, basically they call an open finding.
That's right.
Yeah, so tell me about that. They make the open finding, and how did you feel about that at that time?
Well, I was hoping that the police would continue their investigation, because Coroner Byrne got it right in his conclusions, and the fact that he couldn't rule out foul play was enough. But but the police, as we already know, didn't even think about that during the time, because there was no criminal investigation launched at all. It was basically a post-mortem investigation, and that's all they left it to. And they were satisfied with the autopsy report. They rested on that, and they just drifted along with, and expected us to drift along with it. So with Coroner Byrne, it was satisfying to me that he actually had seen enough of the evidence to say that, look, he couldn't rule out the fact that foul play hadn't taken place with Alana. And given also the males had not been identified and no witnesses had come forward to say that one way or the other. So this is where, like you said, with Hythorn saying, there was no further level inquiries and all that, and the police themselves not going any further with it, because that's what it was. It was left dormant till they got the DNA profiles matched.
So what Byrne said, it was a bit of a double-edged sword. On one hand, you felt good that he had acknowledged that this could still be foul play, but then on the other hand, he sort of said, we're just going to leave this open now, and more or less sounded like, unless something comes along, falls in the police's lap.
He was fair. He said, on the other side of the coin, he said it could have been just another tragic overdose. And so he balanced it out. But I, it wasn't until later that, the balance tilted a lot more the other way.
So what happened? So that day, when you walked out of court that day, did you resign yourself to thinking, okay, I'm going to sort of just take a break from this now? Or what was your sort of resolution when you left that day?
I took, I was hoping, I was never going to give up to try to find out about Alana. So I always kept an open mind, hoping that someone would come up and would find out, or would keep asking questions, etc., around the community and that. And
Let's fast forward. So then, the police, they're dormant completely on the case for another 6 years.
I got on with my life. I started to settle down a bit and get on with my life, because given that the male profiles hadn't been identified, and it seemed to me that nothing could be done until they were, and because they were the people who were last probably with her, and whoever else was with her, and I thought then I just sort of, like I said, I started to get on with my life and settled down a bit, because it was pretty horrific, for the family, but me in particular with Jeff Hythorn, with the way the investigation was conducted, it tore me apart, you know what I mean, emotionally, and also, I was left holding the bag, not getting any, in the end, left with an open finding and not having any answers to Alana's death. So I needed to take a break, and I did. I did, and just started to get on with my life. And then the boat was rocked.
After 6 years of heartache and struggle, Peter finally had a chance to take a breath. It had become clear that the only chance of police reopening Alana's case would be an unlikely match to the two outstanding DNA profiles. And so it was, 6 years later, as Peter was sitting in his home, the phone rang. It was the Melton Police Station, and they wanted Peter to attend an urgent meeting with the homicide squad.
I was just sitting at home, and I got a phone call from the Melton Police Station, and they said that they wanted to organise a meeting with myself and the homicide squad, constable who was David Leverage, and with Jeff Hythorn, investigative officer, and I think it was Sergeant Glenane, who was Ballarat CIU, and so I proceeded to the meeting. I wasn't quite sure what they were going to tell me. I was hoping that they had solved the case and tell the truth, that they had the answers. So I sort of walked in, and then they were sitting there at the seat, and I sat down, and then they proceeded to tell me that they'd identified both profiles.
Wow.
That were found on Alana, the two males, and then one, they then basically said, told me who they were, and one was identified as a 49-year-old Greek man, and an 19-year-old Vietnamese male, and then I looked over at Jeff Hythorn, and he looked at me, and he stated, "I can't believe it." I felt like punching him in the mouth. I honestly did. I was shattered. I honestly, because of what he did and what he put me through, and to hear him now state that after taking the line of investigation he did and the conservative way he went about it, and then come out and now realise that it was more than meets the eye, I felt like punching him in the mouth. Honestly, dude, I was that despondent. I was shattered, to tell the truth. I didn't come out of that meeting too well at all. I was just, I felt like I was in hell, to tell the truth. Because what happened was all the parts of the jigsaw came together. The realization of what happened to Alana and the possibilities of what happened to her once I knew that the males involved, that the two males, and especially them, knowing that that Alana wouldn't have anything to do with a 49-year-old Greek in terms of sex and stuff, and that, obviously realising that, he'd gone been through her, left, in all ways. And, it came to me then, the realisation that everything I was trying to tell the police was all true, but they didn't want to believe it. Yeah. And the fact that Alana was probably raped by these people, probably took her out. All these things came. I was in a shocking state. Because I had all these things going through my head. I really needed help, even coming out of the station, you know, driving home. I was totally upset. I was beside myself. I was very hateful of Hythorn for what he did to me, and not the way, you know, all the heartache he put me through, and to get to this point, it was the most horrifying thing to be told that. And then I had to deal with it. I had to deal with the fact that I had to deal with these two blokes that had sex with my daughter, and the way the sex was performed and everything, and you know, like I said, amounted to rape. It was rape, to my eye. And I also thought about, and it was a natural instinct to think, how much did she suffer in the hands of these two males? And why? Because she would have fought.
Yeah.
Had they, you know, had it, depending on how they went about it, but she would have fought them, and she wasn't gonna. She wouldn't just, because I know Alana, she was a fighter. She wouldn't just lay down and say, "Yeah, come on, have the sex and stuff." She didn't want it. She didn't consent to. It wasn't consensual. She would have fought it, unless she was given drugs. Yeah. And the drugs were put in her, and that's the thing, the key issue.
On this day, in 2008, Peter finally got the answer to the question he was looking for. Who were the two unidentified male DNA profiles? For Peter, the truth only justified his belief that there was more to Alana's death. Both men were known to police. Both were names he'd never heard before. The first was the DNA match from the semen identified in the mouth swab. This profile had been matched to a 30-year-old male of Vietnamese descent who was 18 at the time of Alana's death. Name: Nghia Lu, spelled N-G-H-I-A, Lu. The second, and more concerning, was that of the 61-year-old Greek male whose semen was found present in both the vaginal and rectal swabs. He would have been 49 at the time of Alana's death. Name: Theodosis, or Theo Koumis, K-O-U-M-I-S. Given both of these men were known to police, and their profiles should be considered suspicious given Alana's age and background, surely this would have resulted in a vigorous, fresh police investigation.
So when you left that day, did they say, "Okay, we're chasing these guys up, like we're going to catch them"? What was their mentality? You know, Leverage. What did he say? Was Leverage taking control at this
point? No, at the meeting, they basically said that coroner Jennifer Cope had, because of the obtaining of the two samples, identifying the two samples, DNA profiles, that the coronial, she's opened a second investigation into the case, a coronial investigation, so to speak. It wasn't a criminal investigation. Okay. Still.
Yeah.
It remained a coronial investigation, and it was conducted by David Leverage and Hythorn. And I was pretty upset that Hythorn was still involved because of the mistakes that were made already and missing evidence.
After the discovery of the DNA matches, Coroner Jennifer Cote ordered a new coronial investigation. Just to be clear, a coronial investigation differs from a criminal investigation. A coroner is independent to police, but can make whatever inquiries are necessary to find the cause of death. However, it is not their job to establish criminal guilt of any party involved. However, a coroner can, through their decision, recommend a case be reinvestigated by police. It is up to the police in any given case to make that determination on their own. In 2010, the review into Alana's death was completed, and Peter and his father, a hugely respected former homicide detective, were invited to Melbourne to attend a meeting.
My father and I attended Tender Homicide down in Melbourne, the building, and met with Leverage and Glenane again, and we spoke. And the investigation had been completed, and they spoke to me. And by the way, I hadn't seen any report to that point of the investigation. I hadn't seen anything. So this is a conclusion of the investigation, so to speak, in a meeting, a conclusive meeting. And the meeting went along the lines of, it's been investigated. We've tried to do, get what we can out of it. We haven't been able to solve it, get the answers we wanted to get, we've got it. There is evidence, but we don't believe there's enough there for the prosecution to take it any further. And again, like I said, I hadn't seen the report, and I was expecting more from the second investigation. It was pretty hard because I was in a position where I couldn't actually, when they asked me, myself and my father, was there anything further we wanted to do or what we thought? Well, what were we going to think, because we had nothing in front of us? So, after it was all done, I could easily, once the report came out and I saw it, and then went back, looked over it, and in retrospect, I thought, gee, I could have told them a lot of things I wanted done, but I didn't get a chance at that meeting. And so they also said that they basically understood my position, understood the family's position, and said that, the older male, not making a no comment statement, not answering any questions as to how he came by Alana and the reasons for the sex, etc. They basically went along the lines and said, look, today, in today's world, we can't, we're pretty much under the pump in terms of putting him in the interview box, interview rooms, and everything's under surveillance and camera. And it's not like the old days, and where you can actually, force them to start talking, but which is, obviously right. They made a flippant comment to say that they'd like to hang him from the West Gate Bridge, get it out of him, which was a bit of a laugh at the time. But it was more than that. It was very frustrating to hear that. But there was probably other people because it wasn't a criminal investigation again. They didn't go in and really cross-examine any witnesses, which should have been cross-examined, the alibi witnesses that Alana was with at the time. There's nothing like that was done, and it was, Hythorn's statements were just basically, like he said, he only wrote down what they said.
Yeah,
and if there was any discrepancies, he just put it down the fact that they were druggies and didn't care. It might have been druggies, but they were drug affected. And he put that at the mention hearing, and it was laughable, really, because I actually talked to him when they weren't, and they were quite normal. So it was just a cop out, really. But there was no statements, there's no cross examinations at all as far as the evidence is concerned. So how could they possibly not have anything ready for the prosecutor, apart from the circumstantial evidence, which is plenty. But outside that, there wasn't any. So the police up to this point haven't done anything in that terms of that, which is the thing. But also at that meeting, I was given false hope. I was because I up to that point, I thought I'd done everything I could for Alana, for my daughter, and that was very important to me, because I didn't want to leave anything anything that was left to be done not done for her. So with that, I wrote a number of letters away to the police trying to attract witnesses. I wrote, and I got knocked back, and by them, which I thought was a good point, a good thing, because obviously that was an important part of the thing going forward, that if we can get any new witnesses coming out, then, that could be revealed. But because the investigation basically came to a standstill, it was just left up. So I just took it upon myself to do this. And then I went and saw my local member, and I also come across another politician called Robinson, who wrote to the Attorney General. I wrote to the Federal Attorney General, as well as the State Attorney Generals, and pleaded my case and said about, where the investigation was, and tried to get some action done. There was a lot of things that I wrote, I tried to do it too. But, and also, what happened to me after that 2008 hearing was that, I was given so much time, as you said, to appeal it to Supreme Court or whatever it is. And I hadn't heard the result at all from the Coroner's Court. I hadn't heard anything. I didn't even know it was actually not closed. And it was about a month later that I received a phone call from David Leverage. And he said, he says, have you received your letter? And I said, what letter? And he said, the letter from the Coroner's Court. I said, no, I haven't received any letter from the Coroner's Court. And he was shocked. He'd been on leave for a month or so, and there was a letter on his table from the Coroner's Court, and he'd opened it, and it stated that Jennifer Cope had failed to set aside the findings, closed the case. And he couldn't believe it, that the Coroner's Court hadn't sent me the letter as thing. So eventually it did come out. He must have contacted the Coroner's Court. But by that time, and also the way I was, I couldn't appeal. I wasn't in no state to appeal. I wasn't in a good state. I was actually getting help, to tell you the truth. I was actually, I needed help. I was, and a psychiatrist was helping me, psychologist was helping me, and my local doctor. They teamed up as a three, and basically started putting me back together again. Just a letdown. Because I felt that I failed my daughter, and I shouldn't add. I felt that the system had played against me and defended the investigative officer and themselves in failing to get the case resolved in a timely manner, and so that it could be solved, because as you know, in the police report, it basically said David Leverage stated that it's been so long that he never thought that it will ever be solved, and that's in the report to the coroner.
Yeah.
So the police have basically put their hands up in the air. So hence that's why we're here today,
yeah,
in this position.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It took 12 years to get the crucial evidence they were looking for. 2 DNA matches. In 2002, then-Coroner Byrne had stated he would be delighted to see this case come back with fresh evidence, in particular, a DNA match. And now in 2010, armed with that fresh evidence, Coroner Coate had effectively ruled, case closed. This decision left Peter both physically and mentally destroyed, and he had to seek professional help to recover from the psychological trauma of this case. Every time he closed his eyes, thoughts would flood back about what his daughter may have suffered at the hands of these men. And why were they free to walk the street? You heard Peter mention the 61-year-old Greek, Theo Koumas, had given police a no-comment statement when questioned over how his DNA was present on Alana. You'll recall Coroner Byrne warned Peter of this exact thing, that in the future if these men were found, a no-comment statement is their right by law. As Coroner Byrne stated, that is our system of justice. But whether or not it is just is another story. We're going to finish this episode with that statement, made by Koumas when interviewed by Jeff Hythorn. You already know what's coming, but I want you to live that moment. And imagine Alana was your daughter. How would this statement make you feel? Unfortunately, I don't have the original audio, but this is word for word, and it's being read by an actor.
Theo, do you agree that the time is now 10 minutes past 11 a.m?
Yes.
What is your full name, Theo?
Theodosius Koumas.
Theo, I intend to interview you here in relation to the offence of murder. Before continuing, I must inform you that you do not have to say or do anything, but anything you say or do may be used in evidence. Do you understand that?
Yes.
I must also inform you of the following rights. You have the right to communicate with or attempt to communicate with a friend or relative to inform that person of your whereabouts. You have the right to communicate with or attempt to communicate with a legal practitioner. Do you understand these rights?
Yes.
Do you wish to exercise any of these rights before we proceed?
No.
I'll ask you to speak up as well, Theo. What is your age and date of birth?
61 and 22-10-1947.
Are you an Australian citizen?
Yes.
Are you a permanent resident of Australia?
Yes.
Are you of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander descent?
No.
Okay. Theo, do you agree that we've just come over from the court where we made an application for you to be interviewed?
Yes.
Prior to this interview, have you had any legal advice in relation to this matter?
Yes.
Who did you get advice from?
Legal aid.
That's legal aid here in Ararat?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you some questions in relation to the death of a young 16-year-old girl, which happened on the 10th, on the night of the 9th and 10th of November 1996. The young girl's name was Alana Cecil. She was found dead at a vacant house at 211 Station Road, Melton. Can you tell me anything in relation to the circumstances of her death?
No comment.
Do you know Alana Cecil?
No comment.
Well, Theo, is it your intention to answer no comment to all the questions I put to you in this interview?
No comment.
Is the situation where you're saying no comment on the advice of your legal solicitor?
No comment.
Well, in view of that, and in fairness to you, I'll just put the brief summary of the incident. As stated, Alana Cecil died on the night of the 9th and 10th of November 1996. She was 16 years old in Melton. The circumstance of her death, she died of heroin toxicity, heroin overdose. Your DNA profile was located on a vaginal swab and anal swab of Alana Cecil. She was found with her clothes not on her in the correct position, and we're unable to ascertain how she got there. Are you able to give any indication at all how your DNA came to be on the vaginal and anal swab of Alana Cecil.
No comment.
Just one more quick thing. I've got a photo of Alana Cecil. It's the only photo I have of her. And I'll just show you the camera. That's the photo. Have you seen this girl?
No comment.
Do you know this girl?
No comment.
In view of the fact that you're not going to take the matter any further, there'll be ongoing inquiries in relation to this matter. You do not have to say or do anything unless you wish to do so, but whatever you say or do may be recorded in evidence. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Do you wish to say anything in answer to this charge of murder?
No comment.
Do you wish to make a further statement in relation to the matter?
No comment.
Do you agree that the time is now 14 minutes past 11 a.m?
Yes.
Interview concluded.
Hi Mel, what's your favourite songs now? Mine Are Sexy is the Word by Melissa, Promise of a New Day by Paula Abdul, Pump It by Icy Blue, Big L by Roxette, and Can't Do Nothing for Your Man by Public Enemy. I'm not going out with Adam anymore. I'm going back with Damien. I've been going out with Damien for ages. Hello Craig, how are you? Speaking about Craig, are you still going out with him? Say hello for Katrina for me. We're coming up on the 15th November 1991. We're coming by plane. I can't wait to see you. We're not going to miss your birthday. Well, I better go because I've run out of things to say. Love, Alana.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production. Written, produced and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that. Opinions and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. You'll find further photos, videos and daily updates on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ. If you would like to visit Alana, her family kindly welcomes you. She can be found in Melton Cemetery, under the gum tree, off the Cadros Ave entrance. And of course, make sure you take a moment to look up in the tree for the owl. Voice acting in this episode: Keith Armitage as Theodosius Kumas, Dan Musial as Detective Hythorn, and Alina Cecil as Alana. The fantastic original score was produced specifically for this season of Guilt by Sam Morgan at sunroomsound.com. If you're looking for original music for your project, check out his great work. Our new and improved website, theguiltpodcast.com, was designed by Jacob at Medio Street Media. If you're looking for any help with web, brand design, or digital marketing, you'll find them at mediostreetmedia.com. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding, and you can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details on how to subscribe at theguiltpodcast.com. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.